Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has embarked on a trip to the Asia-Pacific region that will include a visit to South Korea Sunday amid a tense standoff along the Korean Peninsula. Pence left Washington Saturday in what will be a 10-day four-nation trip that will also include stops in Japan, Indonesia, Australia, and Hawaii. And while in South Korea, Pence will meet with its prime minister with local business leaders. A massive display of military might and armor in North Korea as it celebrated its Day of the Sun Saturday, the country's annual commemoration of founding leader Kim Il-sung, born 105 years ago. Kim died in 1994 after 46 years as the supreme leader. His grandfather, or he is the grandfather of current leader Kim Jong-un. The display also comes days after the U.S. dropped its largest non-nuclear bomb on insurgents in Afghanistan. During his weekly radio address while marking the celebrations of the Christian holiday Easter and Jewish holiday Passover within the United States and abroad, U.S. President Donald Trump denounced the attacks on Christians last week in Egypt, but also spoke of unity.
When we're good people of all faiths, Christians and Muslims and Jewish and Hindu, can follow their hearts and worship according to their conscience. With God's grace, life always triumphs over death. Freedom overcomes oppression, and faith extinguishes fear. This is the source of our hope and our confidence in the future.
Mr. Trump also said, when we're good people of all faiths, Christians, Muslims, Jewish, and Hindu, they can follow their hearts and worship according to their conscience. This is VOA News. The top U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, says that the United States used a massive bomb against Islamic State affiliates in Afghanistan in order to remove a strategic roadblock in the fight against the terrorist group.
This was the first time that we encountered an extensive obstacle to our progress that was constituted by the belts of IEDs, the presence of tunnels and caves, and therefore this was the appropriate weapon to use at this time to reduce that obstacle to enable us to continue with our offensive operation in the southern Nangarhar.
Several dozen Islamic State fighters were killed in the explosion, the largest non-nuclear device in the U.S. arsenal. Dozens of Syrians have been reportedly killed and some others wounded in an explosion Saturday on a bus convoy carrying thousands of evacuees. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the blast hit the convoy of mostly Shiite residents. The group was traveling to Aleppo from two villages. Syrian state TV initially reported that 22 people had been killed in the blast in the town. British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights put the death toll at 24 and said the explosion was caused by a car bomb. Thousands of Syrians fleeing four besieged towns had been stuck on the road in the outskirts of Aleppo a full day after leaving their homes. Their passage had been blocked by rebel forces who say the terms of the evacuation deal brokered by Iran and Qatar last month were not observed. That's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Voters in Turkey will consider a constitutional referendum Sunday on whether to transform their government from the current parliamentary system into a powerful executive presidency. As Dorian Jones reports, the issue has split the nation.
For both opponents and supporters, the referendum has come down to one man, incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Yes campaigners believe the proposed reforms are all about enabling the president to continue to carry out his program to develop Turkey. But the fairness of the referendum campaign is increasingly in question. In many areas of Istanbul, like the rest of the country, it can be difficult to find no flags and posters. Numerous no campaign rallies were banned by state officials, including in Istanbul. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Death penalty opponents gathered on the front steps of the Arkansas Capitol in the southern United States to protest the state's plan to execute seven inmates before the end of the month. The Arkansas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty's rally Friday came as a federal judge weighs whether to grant the inmates' request to block their upcoming executions. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
We started with prayers on Friday. And then in Abuja, we had daily marches to the villa. These were not mass marches. These were two-some marches.
Nigeria marks the third anniversary of the abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls by Boko Haram.
Those who were holding office, they're required by law to be able to declare what assets they have so that there's no misuse of public resources for political gain.
The Kenyan electoral body calls on candidates to declare their assets ahead of the upcoming elections.
It is especially gratifying to see that a lot of the young people who are coming into the voting age are preferring my party to others.
And a former Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho campaigns before the June polls. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, Friday was the third anniversary of the abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls by Boko Haram. About 195 of the nearly 300 girls remain in captivity. The group, known as Bring Back Our Girls, organized a series of activities across the country to mark the anniversary. It has also called on the Nigerian government to be transparent and accountable after accusing the administration of complacency. Imam Shehu, a leading member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, told me his group's activities were aimed to pressure the government to expedite efforts to rescue the abducted girls.
1 week of global action, starting in Washington, where Representative Frederica Wilson had a very successful outing with her fellow Congress people. Then coming back to Nigeria, we started with prayers on Friday. And then we had in Abuja, we had daily marches to the villa. These were not mass marches. These were two-some marches under the title, I March for the Chibok Girls. So this was a totally different strategy, which the administration never expected. And then, of course, we capped it up all with the first inaugural Chibok Girls lecture. And the lecture was delivered by His Highness, the Muhammad Sanusi, the Emir of Kano. And, of course, that has reverberated not only within Nigeria, but across the globe.
Two parents of the Chibok girls protested yesterday demanding to meet President Buhari. They were not successful, but were their points made?
Oh, yes, very poignant points they made, because those two mothers have been here in Abuja. They relocated from Chibok and they featured in most of our activities, except in the past few months where I think the stress had gotten to them and they had stayed away. But with this Global Week of Action, they came out, and after the lecture, they concluded the set of matches and totally went off script. I think they got emotionally affected and just walked away from the point where they were just supposed to stop and tie the placards, and decided to walk into the villa. So that caught everybody off guard, including the security people. And the security people ran helter-skelter trying to stop them. And for over 2 hours, there was a stalemate. The women made their point that they were not going anywhere. They were just determined to see the president because they were tired of false promises coming out of the presidency.
The president released a statement saying that he is ready to do everything possible, including negotiations, to ensure the girls are brought back home, and that continued efforts will not be stopped. Isn't that assurances enough?
Well, we know it's a political statement. If you look at the situation since October, nothing had been done. They said a number of girls were going to be the next set, and then everything went silent. It was obvious that the negotiations had broken down, and a government that is sensitive to the pains of our citizens, especially these mothers, would have taken the time to explain to the parents between October and now what the situation is. It shouldn't take another series of action by Bring Back Our Girls chapters all over the world to force the government into making political faith-saving statements.
Some people are saying the enthusiasm and the pressure that you brought bear on the previous administration has not been seen this time around, and that the government is not feeling the pressure, hence the results you are getting right now. What do you say to that?
Now, that is not true. They're just people who don't understand, the dynamics of protests that are properly thought out. Under this administration, we have succeeded in getting 24 girls, and this was due to the pressures we've mounted, the various strategies we have employed under this administration. Under the previous administration, we had no single girl that came back. So that speaks for itself.
Imam Shehu is a leading member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, has informed candidates to declare their assets ahead of the August 8 elections. The electoral body says the directive is aimed to meet a constitutional provision which requires all candidates to declare their assets. The provision prohibits candidates from using state resources during campaigns in the run-up to the polls. This as the IEBC received the first batch of Kenya Integrated Elections Management Systems, the equipment to be used to ensure transparency in the elections. To learn more, I reach Andrew Limu, the spokesman for the Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission.
We just want to give clarity in the fact that those who were holding office, they're required by law to be able to declare what assets they have so that there is no misuse of public resources for political gain. Yeah.
How will the IEBC enforce such law?
Once them giving us the list of all the assets they have at their disposal, we will monitor how they're going to use, whether they're going to use those resources or not. And this should be easy, because if you declare that you have a vehicle, this is the registration number. If we see it being operated in a manner that is not serving public interest, then that is a problem.
When will the IEBC begin such an exercise?
They deliver all the records must be with us by 2nd of May. And I think a week after that and all that, then I think we begin.
I understand there are some concerns when it comes to the issue of the presidency, because the president remains president of the country until the elections are held. Will this law also be enforced when it comes to the presidency?
It's only the president and the deputy president who will not be affected by this year.
Tell me about the Kenya Integrated Elections Management System. I understand the IEBC took charge of some equipment on Friday.
Yeah, you remember, Peter, by law, the verification of voters will be done biometrically. And this was to ensure that people turn up and they are able to check. And we have prepared a draft register from the 10th of May to the 9th of June. They will give an opportunity for people to do verification, to find out whether their names are correct, and they will do this biometrically. But we received 4,000, the first batch of the Kenya Integrated Election Management System, which is a system that comprises voter registration component. It has a component on nomination software. For political parties, it has a component for electronic voter identification system, and also the results transmission. So what we got on Friday is the first batch of 4,000 of these kits, and this is the component that does identification of voters and transmission of results.
When will these be deployed to the rest of the country? Because, as we understand, some of the political parties have expressed concern about the issue of transparency and credibility of the elections.
I think there's no better way to demonstrate accountability and transparency other than using these gadgets and the technology, because then more than ever before, this is the first time voters will verify their status electronically. And for us, it is a big plus, because then we will be able to test the technology that we will use on August the 8th, polling day, because this is the same equipment that we will check in voters.
Andrew, there are concerns that if there are no backups, the electoral processes might resort to the manual verification, which they think can be used to rig the election, which they said could also encourage voter irregularities. How does the IEBC plan to address some of these concerns?
The issue of manual backup was something that was taken out of context. We said in the unlikely event, because when you legislate processes, when you legislate technological processes, and you have a situation where for in the very unlikely situation, you might have one or two places where it malfunctions. We asked, what do we do in the event of that? In some countries, even the agents can come around and say, okay, fine, what's our fallback plan? We're not aspiring for manual. Manual was the unlikely event.
Andrew Limo is the spokesman for the Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. Lesotho Prime Minister Pakadita Mosisidi has fired two cabinet ministers at the behest of the former parties in the seven-party governing coalition. This as the political parties campaign ahead of the June 3 general election. The upcoming polls will be the third since 2012 in the Southern African Kingdom. Early this month, Prime Minister Pakadita Mosisidi lost a vote of no confidence in Parliament after several lawmakers from his ruling Democratic Congress Party coalition defected to join the opposition. To learn more about the political situation in the Kingdom of Lesotho, I reached former Prime Minister Tom Tabani.
I'm having a feel of the climate. As far as I'm concerned, my support base remains solid and it's growing. And that's very comforting for me. It's especially gratifying to see that a lot of the young people who are coming into the voting age are preferring my party to others. I don't know the reason for that, but that's happening. Thirdly, I think that we are now waiting to see the completion of reforms of the security sector in Lesotho. And I'm glad that I'm here now and I'll probably be able to participate in that process.
While you were Prime Minister, you had to leave due to security concerns. What is the current situation on the ground?
It is difficult for me to say because I only was able to make a decision to come home unilaterally, not after any agreement with government, after they had removed the then commander of the Lesotho Defense Force. And I felt that when that man was removed, I would take a chance and come home. I've taken a chance and come, and I've stayed alive. And I've already been outside of the capital campaigning.
Are you endorsing any particular coalition candidate for the prime minister position?
No, not yet. I think I'm still campaigning on my own, but I've always been friends with two other parties, the BNP and the Reformed Congress of Lesotho. But everyone is campaigning on their own. I've also had talks with the former deputy to the present prime minister, who has now formed his own party. I think we are all talking now about the future.
You talked recently about your decision to legally overthrow the government of Pakadita Mosisidi. Are you satisfied with the current political climate at the moment because you are campaigning to be returned as a prime minister when he defeated you in the last elections?
I'm moving around to the countryside and then giving a message to the people that the present prime minister has not succeeded to take the country forward. And what he has done is he has now closed parliament and mentioned a date for election. That now precludes all other activities I would take because now my main occupation now is to campaign to win that election.
What are your realistic chances of becoming the next prime minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho?
They are good because I'm working at it. I'm not just depending on chance. I'm not depending on fate. I work at it. I walk around and give my message to people.
But there seem to be some coalition in the opposition and analysts that, and some Basotho that I have spoken with seem to suggest that their candidate stands a better chance of becoming the prime minister. What do you say to that?
Clearly, everyone speaks for his side, but I'm speaking for my side because I have the numbers countrywide. I don't only have numbers in the cities or the towns or the urban areas. I also have numbers in the rural areas. The only place I haven't really touched is the present prime minister's home base, and it's only 3 constituencies there. So that does not threaten my numbers at all.
Well, but Mr. Tomtabani, why aren't you trying to convince other minor political parties to form a coalition just like you did previously, which others are saying could give you a better chance of becoming the next prime minister?
I think that issue gets misunderstood at some point. The idea is to go out there and hunt and then share the spoils. But also, there are 1 or 2 constituencies which you realize you cannot win, and that one of your collaborators would win there. So it would only make sense to give them a chance to win there so that they can also come back and join with you. But in the majority of the constituencies which I controlled in the past, I'm intending to continue to control them and so on. And then negotiate with our partners a deal on this one, which has not yet been negotiated. But the best deal that is possible here in Lesotho, and looking at the climate here and how we operate generally, is for every man to go and hunt and then share the spoils afterwards. That is the most practical approach as far as the Lesotho situation is concerned, and I'm following that approach.
Tom Tabani is a former Prime Minister of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. An Ethiopian opposition politician is recuperating in a Washington hospital after being subjected to torture and other ill treatment in his country's notorious prisons. Habtamu Ayeleo, the former spokesman for the opposition Andenet or Unity Party, was arrested on July 8, 2014, and charged with terrorism for allegedly collaborating with the opposition Jinbot 7, which the Ethiopian government has designated a terrorist group. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone to find out about his health condition.
Now I'm feeling better. Now I was treated in Georgetown University Hospital. Still have an appointment for checkup and other treatment as well at the same time, because I have a surgery in hemorrhoid, third degree hemorrhoid. That was some complication and it was critical. And now I have an appointment for treatment. There is some damages on my feet and as well in my kidney. So I'm looking forward to the treatment.
You are imprisoned and tortured and prevented from leaving the country. How do you feel about the actions of the Ethiopian government?
I was in prison for 2 years and incarcerated for almost 4 months in central prisoner custody in Makela, which we call Makela, and specifically called Siberia, which is the name given by the place is so hard and cold, and very cold. It's buildings built like to for the people. For the purpose of giving is a very exclusively coldness for prisoner. It's a part of interrogation actually. And I'm looking at the Ethiopian government is really extremely the dictatorial region. If you can try to exercise your right, automatically they will, one, they will put you in jail for so long. Second, directly they will kill you. Third, they will push you to leave your country. Actually, the country leading by just one ethnic group. They are controlling the military. They are controlling the intelligence. They are controlling all the economic sector. And they are controlling the civil service or the government position. And they are controlling the regional government.
You were the spokesman, as you say, of the opposition Andenet party. But the government accused you of collaborating with the Ginbot 7. Does this party have any relation to Ginbot 7?
To tell you frankly, I don't have any relation with Ginbot 7. I have no any communication with. This is just a systematic tool to put the opposition, the strong opposition, to imprison.
We understand you were acquitted by the court, but government appealed your acquittal. What happened to the appeal of the government? Are you still in legal jeopardy in Ethiopia?
Government, as I told you, they are controlling any institution, including the courts. So when we go to in court, that we know we don't have any justice. When we are arrested, it's politically ordered by TPLF. When we are released, it's not like by court decision. As we know, when TPLF decided to be released, you will be released. When TPLF, the Tigray Liberation Front, ordered to be arrested, you will be arrested. Any decision is by TPLF. We've been tried to negotiate and to have a constructive engagement for the country to develop a democracy.
What are your plans? Do you intend to go back to Ethiopia? And if so, under what conditions?
From the bottom of my heart, really, I need to go in my country and to be with my family and to fight for the people with a peaceful democratic struggle. But I can see it's already blocked in everything. There is no any space for peaceful struggle in Ethiopia. However, I will keep to struggle, that I will take time to have a choose in what kind of mechanisms that I have to choose to keep my struggle. Let me do my medical process, and then after I will discuss with my comrades and working with me with the political and social issues. I really can't decide right now. Let me do my medical process.
Haptar Mwaeleo is the former spokesman for the Ethiopian opposition Andenet or Unity Party. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Washington. The number of newly diagnosed childhood cancer cases worldwide rose by 13% during the past two decades, according to an agency of the World Health Organization. Better earlier detection is cited for part of the rise. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Stelia Rova-Fouché says childhood cancers are most likely triggered by genetic predisposition and affect different systems in the body.
The first most common cancer in children is leukemia, and this was seen in all the regions. And then it is followed by cancers of central nervous system in mostly high-income countries. And it was lymphomas in the other world, like low-income countries.
The data were collected from 153 cancer registries in 62 countries, departments, and territories, covering about 10% of the world's children. The best registries of childhood cancer were in Western countries, including the United States, which kept records on almost 100% of sick children. 5% or less of the data came from Africa and Asia, according to the report. In those low-resource settings, Stelia Rova-Fouché says many cancers may go undiagnosed because of a lack of awareness and the unavailability of diagnostic equipment. But she says the collection of data is important for a number of reasons.
It's better will be in next year, so that you have enough amenities to take care of these children. You need to know how much these data provide the first indicator of the burden of in this population.
For the first time, the IARC also gathered cancer data on adolescents between the ages of 15 and 19. The annual incidence during the first decade of the century was 185 cancers in 1 million, with lymphoma and melanoma at the top of the list. By knowing the incidence of childhood cancer, Steliarova Fouché says researchers can begin to identify some of the factors that may contribute to childhood cancer, including environmental pollutants and infections, which might be avoided. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Away from me, yeah. Shakira, Kira, you fine, fine. You killer, killer, you fine pass. Shakira, Kira, follow me down. Ile, ile, give me your love. Tile, tile, follow me down. Ile, ile, give me your love. In my tile, tile, baby, Kojo, I know you can do it. Baby,
she said to Maya, she love my bad boy ting. She said to Maya, me love your sound boy ting.
Let go.
Baby, go do.
She said, give me, give me.
I know you can do it.
Bang, bang.
Make me tango. I know you can do it. Baby, go do. I know you can do it. Baby.
I want to make a legacy.
tunasema sali sali mawa. Shida zetu wenyewe tunazijua. Mwenzako kamoyo kangu kadogo, kukurupuka kana shindwa. Hakuna manati bila kipago, bila ya wewe nitashindwa. Macho yangu unafumba sitambani mwingine. Na penzi langu sio tunda kangata mwingine. Ado mapacha. Ado, ado, tunajikongoja tutafika. Domo, macho, ukaribu wetu kama mapacha. Ana meremeta, ana meremeta, kasura kake kazuri. Ana meremeta, mcheshi hana kiburi. Ana meremeta, kanipa mtoto na ringa. Shera kama masiara, harusi imefika. Sina papara, ubachera, chiko nimevuta. Kiziwi kweli asiki, na kipofu waoni. Mikuwa kwako sijuti, utamu kisogoni. Mtunze penzi langu mama, maji kupa nisije kuzama. Kazuri anameremeta, mcheshi hana kiburi. Anameremeta, kanipa mtoto na ringa. Anameremeta, tumbo yote wamevimba. Cheshi hana kiburi, kanipa mtoto na ringa.
FM,
music can tell it, my number one.
Yeah.
Every night and day, I just give a lot of dance and praise. Store my teacher.
Nigga, I want a fair body, nini, be your baby girl. Ati baki lo kato gbere
e no bi yo ko so pe
emi ti ba won jiya kin to dey bi
se komo
e da ke ba mi gbe go pe
check your body oh it's not the time to dance no be time to dey vex
say my heart tell me say you go just dey dance so and steady you no go give in stress
anything where I be today
komo
na baba god you
oh
the goodness and mercies which I hope I dey give to me you make me happy yeah. Happy day.
To a cash money, I see you.
This kind of music, you go just the dance slow and steady. You know, don't give you stress.
Anything where I be today, come on, now, Baba God.
All the goodness and mercies which I hope they give to me, they make me happy. Yeah. Happy, yeah. It's happy.
It's your boy special. You know, Simon, a bad man.
And that was our music from the continent. Hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if your enemy has thrown the only spear he had at you, it means that he doesn't fear you. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such an individual is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated nationals list. His assets within U.S. reach are immediately frozen, and he is locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. In this way, the United States disrupts support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. Such is the case with Abu Anas al-Ghandour, a military commander for the specially designated foreign terrorist group Hamas. He leads a Hamas brigade in Gaza, has served on the Hamas Shura Council and Political Bureau, and has been involved in many terrorist operations. In June 2006, Ghandour was involved in the attack on an Israeli Defense Forces outpost at the Kerem Shalom border crossing. Two Israeli soldiers were killed, and another two were wounded. A fifth, French-Israeli citizen Gilad Shalit, was kidnapped. He was held in captivity for 5 years. For these and other activities, the United States Department of State designated Abu Anas al-Ghandour as a specially designated global terrorist under Executive Order 13224. Today's action notifies the U.S. public and the international community that Abu Anas al-Ghandour committed or poses a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Designations expose and isolate organizations and individuals and result in denial of access to the U.S. financial system. Moreover, designations can assist or complement other U.S. agencies and governments' law enforcement actions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Yeah.